Yes, 11C. So this agenda paper presents our analysis and recommendations on the items of information to meet the specific disclosure objectives for IFRS 13 on fair value measurement. By way of reminder, one outcome of the post-implementation review of IFRS 13 was to refer disclosure findings to this paper. So throughout this paper, we have made references to both those findings and all of the subsequent research that's been done since the PIR was completed. The board decided to take a different approach to IFRS 13 compared to IS 19, and that approach is to focus on helping preparers to make effective materiality judgment about fair value disclosures. So having developed specific disclosure objectives that explain users why users need particular information at the September meeting, this paper links the existing disclosure requirements in IFRS 13 to those objectives. Before going into our detailed recommendations, I wanted to highlight two specific approaches that apply across all of our recommendations in this paper. The first is about referring to particular levels of the fair value hierarchy in the disclosures. The feedback we've received on the practical consequence of, for example, requiring disclosures items for level 3 fair value measurement is that it encourages the checklist approach. Specifically, that it encourages companies to disclose lots of detailed information about level 3, even if level 3 items are immaterial, and little information about other fair value measurements that may be material. Considering that feedback, we think it would be more helpful to avoid making specific references to levels of the fair value hierarchy in the disclosure items of information. Do not expect that our planned approach would require detailed information for level 1 items and most level 2 items. Instead, it is intended to encourage judgment about eliminating immaterial disclosure and including information about, for example, level 2 items that are close to the level 3 boundary and whose measurement contains significant judgment. The second approach to highlight is about differentiating disclosure items for recurring fair value measurements from non-recurring fair value measurements. Specifically, we've recommended retaining such distinctions as they are currently today. So before going into the specific recommendations, I wanted to pause here in case there are any comments on this two overriding approaches.
I'm glad that you have talked to. I'm glad you've explained about that, because if someone's just looking at this paper and comparing it with the prior one, it looks like we've done it quite differently. Well, we have. With the IAS 19 paper, where we arrive at in terms of the objectives, the reasons, the information needs that are satisfied by fulfilling those objectives, and then the particular line items seem to have grown up organically, seem to have had a lot of discussion. But if one reads this paper, in contrast, it really stands out that there's such a difference in approach. So I think it's important that you did open up this session with explaining why it is that we've arrived at a very different approach. Because if a person just picked this up, there's a danger that it just looks like, oh, here are the things that are required under 13, and we'll just create some objectives and fit them across, because so many of them do fit across. So I think it's really important as we communicate that we explain that we have had a PIR on this, we have a lot of feedback, so there's a reason why we came at it differently.
Mary?
No, I can't speak again.
And
that's it for the day.
I think similar, a parallel comment to Anne's, which is this idea of blurring the boundary between level 2 and level 3 in terms of what disclosures apply or what disclosures would be expected to be made. That to me is, it's very important, and I think it could be quite controversial if we, maybe less so if we explain it in terms of the different approach that's being taken in terms of mandatory objectives. And then maybe less thou shalt, in terms of the requirements, because my recollection, and I apologize, I did not go back to check it, is that in connection with the PIR and in determining the feedback statement, we did not prioritize the standard-setting project to apply, you know, to take the level 3 disclosure requirements and require them to be made for level 2. Now, I think in this different setting, it's fair game to reconsider that. But I think we have to, you know, there's a major messaging point on this one about, even though it's the same point, how in a different context you know, it's a decision to de-emphasize the distinction between level 2 and level 3, and along with encouraging use of materiality to eliminate disclosures, to think about when some of the ones that we have historically required for level 3 would also be relevant for things that might sneak over the border into level 2. So just don't underplay that, because I think many people will see that as a big deal.
I think that's fair. If I could just say one thing, in case it helps jog the board's memory with regard to the PIR, is that when the PIR ended, the decision was made to close that project on the basis of the findings on disclosure looked at in the targeted standards level review project, and it was the case that if last summer the board had not selected IFRS 13 for targeted standards level review, there would have been another discussion about, well, then does that change anything? So I just wouldn't want to give the impression that it was completely everything is perfect. It was on the basis of it being looked at.
We've been talking about materiality in relation to our previous paper, IAS 19, but it really comes home here to me because of what we're changing around level 2 and level 3. And I do agree with what you're doing, the approach to go out in the ED with this approach, that the materiality will apply at level 1, 2 and 3. But thinking about the PIR feedback, there obviously was some concerns about the volume of disclosures around level 3, that there is too much irrelevant and so forth. So once again, materiality is the linchpin, and once again we're going with people's judgments. So I do concur with Mary that there's a messaging here, because otherwise it could look like we just said, oh, you know, everything you do for 3 you now do for 2, because and we don't want to hear that. And I suppose another point is within this is thinking about for us to think more about how that actually applies in terms of when people are making those materiality judgments, what level of disaggregation that they can apply, particularly outside the financial instruments area. So if we've got non-financial revaluation, which occurs in some jurisdictions in relation to some sorts of entities, it is actually there and creating 13 created problems for some particular entities with the amount of disclosure that they had to do. So we need to have some more thought about the disaggregation that would also be part of the materiality judgments.
So,
on this general point, just sort of build on what Anne and Mary have said, I think this whole... I don't disagree with the idea of trying to focus not just, you know, exclusively on level 3 versus other things, but focusing more on, you know, the significance of inputs and the information users need to understand. But I don't think we should underestimate the potential magnitude of that change for people, because I think it's going to... People already find it difficult to make the judgment where you're drawing the line between level 2 and level 3. I think this is an even potentially more difficult judgment for them to make, sort of where within level 2 do I need to start thinking about this. And some people, I think, are going to sort of react at a very high level with the idea that, but it just doesn't make sense for level 2, because by definition you shouldn't have too much soft inputs going in there, so why would it even be in level 2 if I should be thinking about this? So I think we're going to have to really draw out our reasoning and give an opportunity for people to give us thoughtful feedback on the consequence of it.
Any other comments? No? We agree with the staff's recommendation.
Are you on question 1 yet?
No, we've...
Oh, sorry.
This is just the intro.
It's a small overview. Yeah. We haven't got to the question yet.
So we'll move on to the specific recommendations themselves. So the board made separate decisions on specific disclosure objectives for items that's measured at fair value in the balance sheet and for items that are not measured at fair value but for which fair value is disclosed. So I'll start with our recommendations on those items that are measured at fair value. In this area, the board decided to include four specific disclosure objectives. The first objective is discussed in paragraphs 21 to 29 of the paper, and this is on understanding the amount, nature, and other characteristics of classes of items within each level of the fair value hierarchy. We think that the information that's captured by the requirements in paragraphs 93A, 93B, and 98 of IFRS 13 can be linked to this objective. In addition, based on feedback from users, we think the board should also identify that information about the nature, characteristics, and risks of the items in each level may enable an entity to meet this objective. Finally, we think the information that's captured by the existing requirements in paragraphs 93A and 93B of IFRS 13 should be linked using the prescriptive shall language. And this is because we think they would be essential to meet the objective when the fair value measurements are material. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question one, which asks whether you agree to include the items of information in paragraph 28 to meet the specific disclosure objective in this area for recurring and non-recurring fair value measurements.
A couple of reactions. First, when I look at the, and it's very helpful to have the mapping, but when I look at the mapping, I wouldn't have thought about the requirements in the existing requirements in IFRS 13, which are focused more on level 1, 2, and 3, and by class, is getting to the sort of granularity of information that you would need to understand the sort of thing you're talking about in 22A, where you're looking at the relative subjectivity in the assessment. So if we really do want to understand the relative subjectivity in the assessment, I'm not sure that the way that people would read the words today would lead them to think there's such close mapping between the two, but that's something we can learn about when we do, you know, outreach and go out for comments. So it's not a killer, but it's just an observation, so I'm not sure they'd react as benignly as this might suggest. But then the question for you is, if I look at the example in Appendix C, I can see how that meets the sort of thing that paragraph 21 would sound like it's aiming for, so understanding the amount, nature, and characteristics of the stuff you've got in level 1, 2, and 3. But I'm not sure if I looked at Appendix C, the example we've got, that I would think it would help me understand 22A. I'm not sure that that's showing me the relative subjectivity of the assessment. Now, I'm not sure how easy it is to depict that in the disclosures. I'm not sure if I want you to do it, but I'm not sure that I can see a natural link between our example of the sort of information we're thinking of and what we've said we're trying to help users understand.
Yeah. In case it's helpful, I will comment on that. I think with regard to that particular example in the appendix, we were trying to draw out a couple of things, and I think based on the question you've asked, it's clear to me that the example could definitely be improved. So just to explain slightly, the example is firstly trying to communicate that what we are not expecting companies to do here is give a lengthy essay about every single item that it measures at fair value, because there will be many cases in which a group of similar items measured at fair value will have a one-line description in a table, like the table in the appendix, and users will understand that description and they will feel that they have enough. There will be some cases in which more explanation will be needed. So what we tried to do in the example was include one such item and include explanation that helped with the understanding of the nature and such of that one. That said, however, with retrospect, the example that we picked was a level 3 item, and I think the answer to your question about it not explaining how we would get to the grey area stuff, we will perhaps, if we include such an example in any due process document, be better picking a level 2 item for that further sort of drawing out in the example. Yeah.
And also, if we really do want to get people to provide information that enables that assessment of the relative subjectivity of what's within a category to be described, I think putting together trading equity securities as a block as in all trading equity securities are level one, level two, sends an odd sort of message, because I would have thought equity securities would be a prime example of where you could have real differences in sort of how much subjectivity there would be in the assessment. So I think we need to be careful with the signalling we're sending as well. Having said all of that, you know, I'm nervous on the other side about what we're asking people to do. But if this is what we want to propose, I think we need to be careful to have an illustration that actually achieves it.
Thank you, Hans. Just to clarify that 28A is to meet the objective in paragraph 21, isn't it? Just that's not itself a disclosure objective. As we discussed it about the importance of level 1, level 2, level 3, and then here we included this information as a required one, but we didn't link to the paragraph 21.
Yes, so the way we've structured the paper is that at the start of each section with the italic bold headers and the end with a question, the objective at the beginning is the objective that we would be linking the recommended items of information to. So in answer to your question, yes, the item in 28A, as with all of the items in 28, we will be drafting in a way that linked them to the objective in 21 and 22.
Thank you.
Any other comments? This time I can justifiably ask whether you can support staff's recommendation.
It's a better example.
With a better example, it's already
13
conceded.
The second specific disclosure objective, which is discussed in paragraphs 30 to 34 of the paper, is on understanding the significant techniques and inputs that's used in deriving the fair value measurement. We think the information that's captured by the existing requirement in paragraph 93D, 93I, and 96, IFRS 13, would be responsive to user needs around this objective. I'd like to particularly highlight quantitative information about significant unobservable inputs, which is captured by the requirement in paragraph 93D of IFRS 13. We've acknowledged feedback from preparers in the paper that this particular requirement is costly to prepare. However, we think that should be considered in the context of the general feedback that in some cases disclosures are being provided for level 3 fair value measurements when they are immaterial. As mentioned in the introduction, this is one of the areas where we think removing specific references to levels could help alleviate some of those concerns. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 2, which asks whether you agree to include the items of information in paragraph 33 to meet the objective in this area for both recurring and non-recurring measurements.
Sure.
Two comments. First on 33E, this evaluation exception that's in IFRS 13 for sort of the very specific approach that we have for valuing portfolios of financial instruments, which was a massive debate at the time that 13 was issued. And it is an exception from the normal principles. I'm fine with your arguments for why it shouldn't always be provided, because sometimes it's not going to be material or matter or be relevant. But on the flip side, I think it's pretty important that people understand that if you are using this and it is material, we probably would have an expectation that we'd expect to see information about that, because I think it's a pretty important piece of information. The other point was, and I don't feel strongly, just a more question of emphasis, I guess, on 33C, the description of the significant inputs used in the fair value measurement, which is one of the places where we're changing the approach because of this less of a focus on whether it's, you know, level 3, level 2 or whatever. But the effect here is could be quite profound in a way, because you could end up with, in theory, if you look at the paragraph 30 objective, to understand the significant inputs used, that means, I think, that you could end up with a number of cases where the significant input is the listed price without adjustment, which is sort of something you wouldn't emphasise that much in 13 at the moment, because the focus is very much on where there's unobservability and a lot of adjustment or judgment and subjectivity involved. Is that what we mean, or do we still want there to be some focus in terms of where it's a significant thing to understand because of the sort of measurement uncertainty? The way we've drafted it now, I think it's just saying if it's a significant input, you need to tell us about it, but I'm not sure whether that's going too far the other direction.
Yes, it is. So in answer to your clarification, it's the latter that you described, so it's not...
It's not coming through to me at the moment.
Okay.
Mary? Go back to Sue's comment about 33E. Sue, you seem to be saying, I'm okay with making this elective rather than mandatory, because if it's not material, I wouldn't want to require it, which raises for me a general point about how we're using the one-up mandatory, that intro language. I'd assume that if materiality applies overall, that materiality would not be a reason that you would... Sorry, I have too many knots in here. But I think this just brings out something that is a general idea, that if the only reason something would be omitted is because it's not material, then it should be a shall, because materiality would always apply. And if you would put something under the not Mary approved language of that, well, not mandatory, blah, 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 if you think there are other disclosures, other ways of satisfying that objective, if you're in a circumstance in which you have used the valuation exception. And I can't think of a way that you could, if you've used the valuation exception and if the amount involved is material, that you could not tell somebody that I've used that exception,
Yeah, I understand the point completely. If I could...
Okay, that's good, because that was a very garbled explanation.
No, it made perfect sense. So actually, I think you aimed it at Sue, but I'll answer. She might want to tell me that I've answered the wrong question. But the thing that's special about paragraph 33A is not so much the materiality point, but the fact that there will be many cases in which this fact just doesn't exist. So regardless of materiality, an entity won't have made the accounting policy decision in question. Disclosure of that, there will just be nothing to disclose. It won't be a materiality judgment as such. So in answer to the sort of paper 11A question of, can you have an IFRS 13 disclosure note without this, and that be a good enough note? The answer is yes, you can, so it wouldn't always be needed.
But if the only reason is because either you didn't use it or because you used it but the amount was not material, I think we're still saying it's a shall. It doesn't apply.
If you've made that election, it could be a shall. Is that another way of doing it?
If people prefer to do it that way.
So, I mean, I do prefer, but I'm also trying to get to the heart of what we put in the subcategory, which is you expect to be the main category of not mandatory, but
is
things. I think we would not put it in there if we always want it to be done if it's present. The same way we say for business combinations. Obviously, if you haven't had a business combination in the current period, you don't have to do the disclosures about business combinations in the current period. But if you have done a business combination...
So the bar that we are recommending, so if I may contrast this to the very first recommendation in this paper, which is a shall, is that question of, can you have an acceptable fair value measurement note in the absence of this? And here we would say yes, but when we came to that recommendation where it was, tell us what you've measured at fair value, we would say, no, you simply can't have a good enough fair value measurement note without. So that's the bar that we...
And I think for this one, if you've made this accounting policy election, then I think you will not have an acceptable... I personally think you would not have an acceptable fair value note if you do not say we use this exception. Exception, yes, I wanted to call it the right thing.
Yeah, I think that's fair, yes.
Any other comments?
We change it to a shall then, subject to.
If
you've made that policy election.
Yeah, if introducing if shalls is a direction that everyone supports, then yes, we'd be happy to do that.
Do we agree with that? That's the modification.
Rickett, 12. The third specific objective, which is discussed in paragraphs 35 to 34 of the paper, is on understanding drivers of change in the fair value measurement. I think the information that's captured by the existing requirements in paragraphs 93C, 93E, and 93F of IFRS 13 is directly responsive to the objective. This requirement is specific to particular levels of the fair value hierarchy, and for the reasons we've previously discussed, we think this set of information should not be limited to those levels in linking them to the objective. We also think some information that's observed through the IFRS Taxonomy Common Practice Project should be included as part of the items of information, and this specifically relates to disclosures that there have been no transfers between levels and the effect of foreign exchange rates on fair value measurements. Finally, based on user feedback and similar to IAS 19, we also recommend that the board should treat reconciliation as one way of meeting the objective, but not the only way. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 3, which asks whether you agree to include the items of information in paragraph 43 to meet the objective in this area for recurring fair value measurements only.
Mary?
On 43A1, I struggle with just saying a narrative explanation without also requiring some kind of quantification. And let me explain what I mean by an illustration. Significant drivers of change during the period were largely due to increases in the value of equity instruments, as opposed to 60% of the change in value was due to that. Not saying the reconciliation that requires you to specify every component, but you know, when I think about us trying to balance flexibility but avoiding boilerplate, I'd expect if we're doing significant drivers, I'd want, if somebody is just giving me a narrative, I want some kind of quantification of what proportion of the change in value is due to that narrative description. I think that's a lot of relief from tabular reconciliation, and just saying narrative as it is right now just seems way too open.
In case it's helpful at all, we didn't repeat a similar example in this paper of different ways this might be met. So in the previous paper, we had an appendix which did have one that was a table and one that was more of an explanation. So just in case it adds clarity for anyone in thinking about that point, that's the kind of distinction we had in mind in paragraph 43. There.
So I think that the proposals here are sort of focused on one thing, but maybe doing three things. So, and I agree with the first thing, but I question the second and third thing. So the first thing I think that you're proposing is to be less prescriptive in terms of saying it has to be a reconciliation and less prescriptive about what the content of that reconciliation has to be, and rather focusing on what the information need is and flagging that a reconciliation may be one way to achieve that. I'm fine with that. But I think there's two other things that maybe are happening as a result of this proposal. One is that previously, the specific requirements were giving information on where the effects of fair value changes have turned up, so whether they've turned up in profit or loss or whether they've turned up in other comprehensive income. So it was sort of partly the effects on the financial statements, and I can't see that we've got an objective somewhere that's focusing so much on... We're focusing very much on help me understand what's behind your fair value measurement numbers and how much subjectivity there is. We don't have a bit that we do have in 19. Mm-hmm. In terms of explain the financial statement effects. And I think that people probably are interested in where in the financial statements these remeasurements are turning up. whether they're in P&L and OCI, so I wonder whether we need to have an objective that's focusing on the effects on the financial statements. We do that in what we're working on in 19, and we already do that for hedge accounting in 7. And the other thing that I think is happening potentially because of... So, for example, I don't think 44... Some of the stuff we've got in 44, I don't think you would need to do to meet the objective as we've got it at the moment, because why would you have to talk about what's gone to P&L or OCI to meet our objective, whereas if we bring the statement effect in, we'll get that. The other thing I think that we are doing sort of maybe on purpose, but I'm just questioning whether we really want to do this, is at the moment there is these specific requirements on Level 3. And I know in part that we want to get away from the strict Level 3, lots of information, other levels not so much. But one of the benefits of this at the moment is if you are somebody who's looking at profit or loss and trying to work out how much is a safe dividend distribution or how much is a safe bonus payment, or you're a regulator and you're looking at how strong is the capital of a bank, you can get an idea of how much Level 3 stuff is affecting P&L and other comprehensive income. I don't think there's anything that we're saying now that will result in that information being provided. And I'm not sure how well that information loss will go down.
Okay, I think your points 2 and 3 are related. So in answer to the kind of question, it's not a question. I agree with the observation that we don't have an equivalent here to what we had in the other paper about an objective to explain the effects on the financial statements. The reason that we don't have that and hadn't recommended it previously is because that isn't actually something that came through all of the feedback we had. Now, you could speculate about why that is. It might be that the effect on OCI, for example, is often visible from the statement of OCI, so it's not coming through as something to do with the pensions note that people are raising. But in terms of the objective on drivers of change, following the logic of the feedback we had and that being the underlying objective, I think we've responded to that. So I think what you're highlighting is a different objective.
Relative to what we've got in 13 now.
I think it is that drivers of change objective equivalent to what we've got in IAS 19, which would make sense. My reservation would be the fact that it didn't come through the outreach process that we've undertaken, but the stakeholder types that you mentioned in your summary, regulators and such, we haven't spoken to yet, so it might be one that's...
I just think for us as a board, even though an investor hasn't put up their hand and said, I want this piece of information, I wonder whether that's because the focus has mainly been on the measurement uncertainty aspects of it and getting good information about that, so they may not have thought through the consequence, but I'm not sure. I'm happy to move away from a prescriptive reconciliation, but I'm personally, I think, loath to lose the objective, or some sort of objective that says, help me understand the effect on the financial statements, which is sort of getting at, maybe not the Level 3 specifically, but tell me whether it's gone to P&L or other comprehensive income. Because I still think we've got so much nervousness about fair value measurement in IFRS, mm-hmm. that understanding where stuff has turned up so you can, you know, look for it and adjust for it if you're feeling nervous about it, mm-hmm. is probably something I, as a board member, think is important.
Okay. Totally agree.
Okay.
Chen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Just one comment on paragraph 43B. Currently, the entity needs to disclose the reasons for any transfers between levels. In the meantime, the entity also needs to disclose the policy for determining when transfers are deemed to have occurred. From my point of view, I think both there overlap between the reasons and the policy. If the entity disclose the reasons for transfers, actually it will be consistent with the policy, because otherwise, how can it happen? And secondly, it required entity to disclose the policy for determining, you know, when transfers are deemed to have occurred. It sounds like company has a policy choice to determine, you know, when transfer will happen, occur or not. Because the standards are already clear, level 1, level 2, level 3, the criteria when they should transfer or not. So whether the company still needed to develop a policy where they should be transferred or not. Yeah. So well, from my point of view, simply disclose the reason for transfer. I think it's sufficient and enough. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, just to sort of answer the underlying question there.
Yeah.
In terms of whether we, you know, whether it's necessary, what we heard throughout our outreach program, which was quite comprehensive, was that there is certainly a grey area, if I may call it that, between level two and level three, and there are, you know, certainly a number of users out there who feel that the categorisation of items within that grey area is subject to decision making, and if something within that grey area had moved between the two, they would be interested in as to why that decision had been made. So I completely agree in terms of the standard and what it says, but the way that some have described it to us is that it's less three absolutely distinct buckets with a bright line between them and more a continuum of things, and with level two, some of it is a lot closer to level three, and it's that area that's close, that where that could be an interesting piece of information.
Dale.
Thank you, Hans. In general, I support the staff recommendation, except for 43C, disclosure of the fact when there have been no transfers during the period. I think that if there were transfers during the period, in some way it will be disclosed. If there isn't, or it's not material, if it is not there, actually, it is because it didn't happen or because it is not material. I really, it's not just for IFRS 13. I don't think that we should disclose when there is no transfer, that if that is not a transaction. I mean, that if the transaction is not there, is not disclosed, it means that didn't happen or is not material.
Mary?
Going back to Sue's point, one on process and one on the specific point about information about where things are reported, I also think that we need to think about whether we need that objective. I guess it kind of goes back to when I was thinking about IAS 19, distinguishing between analysis of the recognized amount, you know, and saying to people, this is information we're giving you about the obligation that's on, you know, at the reporting date versus other information. I think saying to people, this is discussion, and here's how it relates to the amounts that you see flowing through the primary financial statements and where these changes in value have hit. But also the process point is, if when we look at an existing standard, and I think this comes back to the comparison you're planning to bring next time, something that currently is required that is seen as, you know, maybe a significant piece, and on reflection we're proposing to not mandate it, I think we should highlight that. Because people don't always, you know, just in the invitation to comment, because people don't always look to see what's not there. And I think if we want to make sure that people are okay with some things going away, we should identify with either things that are being dropped entirely or things that are moving from the, you know, required to possible. Not excruciating detail every single one. But think about saying to people, here are some of the big changes that would result from this approach. Because I think otherwise we won't get kind of rounded input.
Peter?
This is linked to Sue's third point. It's about the unrealized gains and losses. So I think that requirement was put in level three originally because people were very users were very worried about the subjectivity of the level three measurements and the possibility of unrealized gains there. And so you might not have heard much from the users now, but there was a lot when these were first put in.
François.
I'm following the conversation, and I don't see why what we have in the various items in paragraph 44, 44B, 44C, 44D, that's not fulfill the need you're highlighting.
But I don't think it's reflected in the objective in paragraph 35. It's just completing the loop. Making sure that 44 actually ties into the objective. That's all we want to do. I agree with you. 44 would do it, but I'm not sure, hand on heart, we could say that that's required by the objective.
It's more drafting.
So you're just asking to redraft this?
Yes, to make it clear that one of the objectives...
You have from the beginning of the reporting period to the end of it.
No, but to redraft the objective in paragraph 35, not the...
Okay, so it's just a question of drafting.
I don't agree with that because I fear that when this will end in that banks, I think, have to disclose then a full reconciliation of all fair value measurements level 1, 2, and 3 because I would expect that banking regulators will give best practice guidance for banks, and then I think it's only possible to fulfill that if you have really a proper reconciliation, otherwise how should you do it? And then we have a lot of disclosure of level 1 movements in fair values. They have to do what is realized, what is unrealized, and all this kind of debate, I think, is not a good debate for us because then it is all people who think, okay, fair value criticism, say, okay, it is what I always wanted to do, realized and unrealized. And for non-banks, I think it will end up that we don't will have this level 3 reconciliation because they will say main drivers of fair value movements was maybe sales. That's it. And therefore, I think that is really... coming back to what I think, when it is a kind of, I expect that we doing detailed disclosure requirements, what we think will fulfill this need, but not leave it to preparers. And that is, for me, a good example that could end up in totally different aspects. Because, as I said, we will end up in high costs for banks because they have to do a detailed reconciliation of level one stuff, which is not necessary because it would be, I think, rules and by banking regulators that is best practice. And for others, I think, maybe not banking companies, we would not require any longer a full reconciliation and we will get boilerplate. Main driver was we have sold stuff. And that is, I think, would not be a good outcome and therefore I am not in favor of that.
Okay, with the comments having been made?
I'm inclined to suggest that the point about the objective around effects on the financial statements, it might be that the board members might not want to vote on that without something in front of them. So, you know, happy either way. If the board is comfortable to vote on that basis, then we're fine with that. But equally, we'd be happy to bring that bit back and just vote on 43 probably needs to be the three parts separately. It's actually a separate issue. Yeah? Yes. So okay. I think that the point that's... Yeah. Yeah. So I think then we would be able to vote on 43 as it stands, excepting that it's highlighted something else that needs to come back. Is that fair? Okay. And given what was said, it might be A, B and C separately because I think the numbers might be different.
So... But for
43A.
Not 44?
11. 12, okay.
It is.
All right.
43B?
Yes.
Yeah. 43B. So the reasons for transfers and the policy.
Are we doing the other?
13.
Disclosure of where there's 43C, no transfers.
Yeah?
Zero.
We really did need to vote on the separate level.
Okay.
Moving on.
So our last specific disclosure objective for items that's measured at fair value in the balance sheet is on understanding the range of reasonably possible fair values. And here we think the information that's captured at the existing requirements in paragraph 93H of IFRS 13 should be linked to this objective without making specific references to level 3. Furthermore, we think in linking this disclosure requirement, the board should replace specific references to sensitivity with measurement uncertainty to clarify that the disclosure is not intended to be forward-looking. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 4, which asks whether you agree to include the items of information in paragraph 51 to meet the objective for recurring fair value measurement only.
I support this. I just have just echo something. I still think we'll need guidance on reasonably possible before this is all over. And just a quick question on A, 4051A. In the objective, we just talked about the reasonably possible fair values. And then this introduces sort of this additional idea, those that result in a significantly higher or lower. Do we really want that, or do we just want what are the reasonably possible fair values, as opposed to having this rider attached?
Sorry, Tom, would you mind repeating the question?
In the overall objective in paragraph 45, mm-hmm. it simply says the range of reasonably possible fair values. That's fine. And then in the 51, it mostly talks about reasonably possible alternative inputs and stuff, except in A, it talks about significant, those reasonably been different, which I'll translate as reasonably possible, and resulted in significantly higher or lower. So now we're not just going to do the reasonably possible, we're going to do a subset of the reasonably possible that result in significantly. And I'm not sure that the significantly helps.
You're trying to focus in on where there's significant measurement uncertainty by focusing on that, I presume, yeah?
Yes. So essentially, I don't know if this is a good way to describe it, but with the objective in 45, it's like understanding the range could be achieved in a number of different ways. So with regard to the item in 51A particularly, if something could have resulted in a significantly higher or lower fair value measurement, that in and of itself would help in the understanding that's underlying the objective.
Okay, and if it just because back to, you could say, for reasonably possible, the range is narrow, right? That's what I meant. So you would still maybe tell people if you have a very narrow range.
Yes. So
you wouldn't only tell them if they, in other words, you might want to separate yourself from all the people with a really big range. And so I don't know, it seemed to me that's why everything else is about the reasonably possible assumptions and the range, and then we have this anyway, I just wanted to make sure that whether you think it's genuinely adding or not.
I think it helps focus on where there's measurement
uncertainty. Yes, I mean, we do. Sorry, I know we're not answering the question, but it might be one to take offline, but we would, you know, there would be scenarios in which each of those items in 51 would contribute to the understanding that we're trying to get to in the objective. So, you know, as you said, there will be cases where the range is very narrow and you wouldn't want chapter and verse about it, but in a case where something could lead to a significantly higher or lower fair value measurement, then you might want more. Sorry, I don't know if I've misunderstood the question.
Well, it's just, if I compared A and B, and is B a modifying A? Or is it totally distinct? Because it says reflecting the higher and lower fair value measurement. And is that referring to the higher or lower fair value in A, or is it referring to a different one?
Well,
it's different ways of achieving it.
Yeah, so for example, you could have a circumstance in which, you know, the effect of particular inputs in their individuality wasn't sort of worth going into in a really granular level, but a really useful piece of information might be best case scenario, worst case scenario, which would be more along the lines of what B is getting at. If there was a circumstance where there were a couple of really significant inputs that would have themselves a significant effect on the range of reasonably possible fair values, then you might be more looking at what's in A. So it's kind of we're wanting companies to give the best information based on the particular set that they are working with.
That helps me a lot. So I'll just say back what I understand. So A is focusing on, are there specific inputs that can really drive a significant change? And B is saying, for collection of inputs, what's the reasonable range? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Any staff recommendation?
Can I just...
Yes, Tadeo.
Sorry. I was trying to look at the previous disclosure just to understand here. It's just the way that is written here. When you think reasonably possible, one thing is in relation to the input I'm using. And, for example, let's say that this input, it's an exchange rate. One thing is what the exchange rate on that date is just one. Therefore, there is no reasonably possible. This is one kind of thing that we might be asking when I'm including the inputs that are non-observable data. Mm-hmm. I could use three or four, and then I have to explain what would be this. And another thing is that what we have in IFRS 7, for example, when I can have a reasonable shift in exchange rate, for example, that could 10% more, 10% less. What we are trying to say here is in relation to the input, the alternatives we have, or how that input that at that time is just the one could change in a period.
As at the reporting date, it's not over the period, yeah?
Yeah, so it's about what is the measurement uncertainty that exists at the reporting date. So if there isn't a reasonably possible alternative, if I may phrase it like that, then there really isn't any measurement uncertainty to disclose. But if you have got a potential range for an input, picked somewhere within that range, and it could move a significant amount in either direction and therefore affect fair value measurement, then that we would want to capture.
Thank you.
Okay.
Question 4. 13. And next, we'll turn to our recommendations on items that are not measured fair value in the balance sheet, but for which fair value is disclosed in the notes. The board had tentatively decided to include only one specific disclosure objective for these items, and that is about understanding the amount, nature, and other characteristics of the items within each level. IFRS 13 currently requires companies to disclose the information in paragraphs 93B, 93D, and 93I of the standard. We think the information that's captured by the requirement in paragraph 93B is directly responsive to the objective and should therefore be linked. However, we think the remaining requirements capture detailed information that users have told us they don't need and that do not relate to the objective that the board has decided to include. Furthermore, and similar to the items that's measured at fair value in the balance sheet, we think the board should also identify that information about nature, characteristics, and risks of the items in each level may enable an entity to meet this objective. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 5, which asks whether you agree to include the items of information in paragraph 58.
Do we agree?
13. Okay, thank you. So the final section of this paper discusses our recommendations on the remaining disclosure requirements or guidance in IFRS 13 that we have not discussed. Firstly, the factors in paragraph 92 of IFRS 13 that an entity is required to consider in providing information to meet the disclosure objective in the standard. We think the content of this requirement has already been captured by the high-level catch-all disclosure objective that the board has decided to include. Therefore, we recommend that the board should not link this requirement to the specific disclosure objectives as well. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 6.
Tom?
Just a quick, so does that mean paragraph 92 goes away or it just isn't linked?
It goes away as a separate requirement, but okay. Its content is part of...
That's what I gathered. Objective. Okay, so it's just gone.
Paragraph 30 captures it anyway, yeah, doesn't it?
Okay.
Can we get a show of hands?
12, one absent.
Secondly, the disclosure requirement in paragraph 93G of IFRS 13 on valuation processes. So feedback from the PIR of IFRS 13 indicates that users found information about valuation processes useful. We especially wanted to highlight this point, as we've heard since posting that this is not as clear as it might be in the paper. While users in our detailed outreach also found the information useful, they said the information that would be captured by some of the specific disclosure objectives that the board has already discussed today would be more useful for their analysis. So in light of that and the similar consideration for the FASB in this area, we recommend that the board should not retain this disclosure requirement in paragraph 93G of IFRS 13. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 7.
That's just Tom.
It was in our literature.
Like, the board members who stick to formalities.
In our literature review, the evidence was that understanding valuation techniques enhanced level 3 measurements, and that the things appeared to be valued better. So we're just wondering about that evidence, if we're dropping this.
Sorry, when you say things appeared to be valued better, do you mean the disclosure had an effect on the quality of valuations?
Yeah, it seemed value relevant, and it was valued differently if you put in more detail about your techniques.
Okay.
The paper was by Hamami and somebody else. It's in the literature review we did for the PIR.
I don't know that we can answer the question directly other than to explain why we think that the factors to remove it override the ones to keep it. You know, there are arguments to say that it is useful information for a number of reasons, but it didn't come through all of the research we've done as being part of satisfying a fundamental objective that users have. So on balance, we think that's kind of the killer test in terms of whether it goes in or not.
Sue?
Is it not covered by paragraph 30 anyway, then?
Paragraph 30 of the paper?
Of the paper. I wondered whether we didn't need it anyhow because it's covered by that objective. Because surely isn't this a significant technique used to derive your fair value measurement?
Yeah, I mean, I think as it stands, we talk about processes separately, and we feel there's value so much in keeping that. I mean, it might be part and parcel of the same thing that we don't believe there's any information that would be lost by removing this that would mean an objective that exists in terms of information need fail to be satisfied.
So this would mean, for example, that if you were measuring, I don't know, an unquoted equity instrument, you would no longer need to describe the valuation process that you used to go through? Or is this...
You'd need to give enough to satisfy the objective about techniques and inputs. We don't think there's two sort of different underlying needs to satisfy.
Yeah, which is why I think it's sort of covered by 30 anyway, paragraph 30 of the paper anyway.
Martin,
also second. Would that mean that a bank don't have to describe regarding the evaluation process who is doing that, who is reviewing that, and it is all not necessary because users don't find it useful?
Well, they'd have to give enough information in response to an objective earlier in the paper.
But the process is different from the technique, right? I think technique is okay to make the discounted cash flow model and whatever kind of inputs, but the evaluation process is, I think, who's doing it, which controls exist, and all this kind of stuff, which I would think is very useful.
From a governance
perspective. For level 3 stuff. And if that is required, I'm not an expert in that, but I don't know. People don't find that useful because that gives me some
comfort
in measurement certainty or uncertainty and this kind of stuff more than other disclosure.
Yeah.
If that is for me, is that not true?
Can I make
I mean, do we ask the question? Should we consult on it and see if people come back and say, yes, actually, this is really... I mean, we haven't heard it in our outreach. Yeah. But if people come back and say, actually, this is really valuable, then we simply reconsider at that stage.
I mean, just in terms of reminder on the process, so we talked about what the underlying objectives are first, which are all the things we decided on in a previous month. Part of the outreach process was also with every user that we spoke to, we went through examples of IFRS 13 disclosures that they analysed, and this didn't come through as something they were saying, you know, we need this because it satisfies this need.
So, Nick, you propose not...
No, I would support staff recommendation that so far then we can consult on
highlight it's been removed, so
see what, yeah, see what the response is.
You know, highlight this is gone, and are you sure you're okay?
Yeah, I see who supports the staff recommendation.
11.
The third one is on the application guidance that's contained in paragraph 94 of IFRS 13 on determining the appropriate classes of assets and liabilities, as well as in paragraph 95 of IFRS 13 on the policy for determining when transfers between levels have occurred. I think these guidances are helpful, so we're recommending that the board should retain this requirement and to link the information in them to the relevant specific disclosure objectives that we, as described in paragraph 66 of the paper. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 8.
Can we support staff recommendation?
13. So finally, the requirement in paragraph 99 of IFRS 13 to present quantitative disclosures in a tabular format. For the reason that we describe in paragraph 69 of the paper, we recommend that the board should not retain this requirement. So I'll turn over to the board to discuss and vote on question 9.
We're going to have some disagreement here. Mary.
Well, I have a question rather than knowing I have a disagreement. And the question is, what, if anything, did we hear from users about tabular presentations? And I ask that because...
I love it.
Yes, yeah. Generally, that I remember that Steve Cooper certainly kept emphasizing the power of tabular presentations, I think, and some of your research long ago and far away did that too. Yeah. So I just wondered what we'd heard.
Don't forget taxonomy. Peter?
Did we hear anything in the outreach?
Our outreach was very much focused on, you know, as I described, going through what is got, what information is given in company disclosures and what is useful and why. This did not really come up in that context. I'd say the most prevalent feedback we've got about the usefulness of this is almost going back to when we were talking about POD and potentially coming up with presentation requirements, because I think it's acknowledged that tabular is a useful way to do things, but I think that is across all of the disclosure requirements in all of the standards. So
we didn't hear, we love this, don't touch it, and we didn't hear, we couldn't care less.
I don't want to misrepresent it. We do have feedback within the broader disclosure initiative that it is useful, but I think we would question whether in one particular case we should be highlighting it when we haven't sort of got reason to do so, if that makes sense.
So I agree, it looks quite odd at the moment when we look at everything else we're doing, but when this was first put in IFRS 13, there was a lot of debate at the time and it was pushed for very hard by users.
Yeah.
I was involved in some of that work at the time, and
now you're in trouble.
We went through an exercise at looking at what some of the practices were at the time in terms of the disclosures, and you know what different banks in particular were doing, and some of them were just very, very difficult to read because they were very, very narrative. Okay. And if you contrasted that with the banks who'd chosen to do it on a tabular basis, I think that was one of the reasons why we did it. And just to Hans's point about users generally love this. I know that, you know, every time users get control of setting requirements, like the EDTF, the Enhanced Task, the Disclosure Task Force, the FSB set up, and also at the moment there's been work done with the Bank of England coming up with some more suggestions of best practice for ECL disclosures under IFRS 9. all they do is produce templates because they love it. So even though I know it sort of jars a little bit fast with our sort of principles-based approach, I think it is quite a good message. And I'm not sure that we have enough specificity in what we've been voting on to be comfortable that the objectives are sufficient to sort of give a steer on this particular aspect. So personally, I'm not sure if it's broken enough to adjust it.
Hans had also mentioned the taxonomy in passing. Are there implications to the taxonomy if we were to specify tabular versus not?
You could still end up with the taxonomy tagging whether you went for tabular or you went for non-tabular. The tagging would just be different. I think you end up with probably more granularity if you've got a tabular type format, and so more detailed tags within the taxonomy. But but I think either way you could end up with the taxonomy dealing with it.
Who supports this? Well, sorry, Tom. Sorry.
Just a couple of comments. First off, when I look at 99, and part of this, if we keep it, we'd have to change it, I think, because it says an entity shall present the quantitative disclosures required by this IFRS in a tabular format unless another format is more appropriate. So it seems to be an omnibus requirement, right? It's to all the disclosures. So I would think of it in that, if we keep it, it has to be in that context. Also, because now we've gone to shall and, you know, not necessarily or not mandatory, then we'd probably have to change the wording because tabular would apply to some of the not mandatory but not all of them. But then I would come back that, you know, there are a ton of studies that show that people incorporate tabular better. A lot of people have said that. Again, in the literature review of the PIR, they actually found evidence that the stuff was incorporated into price better, same study, that tabular actually made a difference in how it was priced. So it seems to me that there's a lot of evidence that tabular is a good thing. And I, what Peter said, like I looked in the basis, I couldn't find anything in the basis about why tabular, but I'm assuming they had a good reason. So I would think, really, could we get wording in here that wouldn't knock the judgment about disclosure off the rails, but still signal quite strongly that there is a lot of evidence that tabular is a better way to go in most cases, because I think there is pretty compelling evidence to that effect.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't see drafting as a reason why we couldn't keep it. So I'm sure we will be able to draft it within the rest of the proposals in a workable way.
Okay, let's see who supports the staff recommendation.
A terrible way to end. Make up another question we can say.
Okay. Thank you very much.